It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, from the White House to the White Pillars Museum in De Pere, we'll explore a collection of presidential artifacts on display here in the state.
First, with another election victory now in his rearview mirror, Governor Scott Walker is beginning the process of laying out his agenda for his second term. He'll do so with a larger and more conservative Republican majority in the state legislature.
And some of the leaders in the legislature are eager to get started, including Assembly Speaker Robin Voss. In a recent press conference, he laid out his priorities for Assembly Republicans, including tax cuts and an expansion of the state's voucher school program, among other things. Whatever ends up happening, any legislative action will come under closer scrutiny than usual as speculation over Governor Walker's presidential aspirations heats up.
Joining us now to talk about the state's legislative agenda is Mary Spicuzza, state government reporter at the Wisconsin State Journal. Mary, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let's take a look at the new state legislature. It's the same party in total control, but with a stronger majority this time. How would you describe the new power differential in the state Senate and Assembly?
You know, Speaker Voss was obviously very happy yesterday during his press conference. His majority expanded. They had 60. It looks like they're now going to have 63 seats. But I think the real difference is going to be in the Senate, where they expanded their majority. Republicans now hold 19 compared to the Democrats, 14. So that's going to make a difference in that, you know, before there would be one or two Republicans who didn't support something and they could really block legislation from being passed. Now, with that broader majority, it seems like Republicans really see that a conservative agenda will have virtually no obstacles in its way.
You mentioned some high spirits with Speaker Voss. What's the general mood among state Republicans as they look at their to-do list?
Gosh, it was almost giddy yesterday, I would say. They were, you know, just they obviously are excited about the election results and say they're ready to get back to work. I think things could get very busy here as early January, right after everybody is sworn in and they're going to take off for the next session. Speaker Voss is, you know, he really has already, like, a, you know, his written list. They were calling it the Assembly Republicans' plans for going forward. They put out a packet of quite a few details, drug testing for benefits, overhauling the GAB. We're still not entirely sure what that's going to look like, changing the how secret John Doe investigations are conducted. Obviously, they want to continue pushing for tax cuts, both income tax and property tax cuts. But he really laid out quite a number of things that they want to tackle among Assembly Republicans. Senate Republicans were still waiting to hear. I asked Senate Majority Fitzgerald about it yesterday, and he said that he really wanted to meet with his caucus to talk with them about their priorities, especially because they have so many new members. So he really didn't want to lay out an agenda. But Speaker Voss is pretty clear that he is ready to go.
Now, I want to get your take on a recent quote from Governor Walker. He said, we're going to be even more aggressive now. And some analysts would look at, you know, the past couple of years and say he's been rather aggressive. If you look at the Act 10 legislation, for instance, what do you think a statement like that signals for what's ahead?
You know, I think in terms of school vouchers, for example, there were Republicans who took issue with just kind of unlimited school vouchers. Senator Ellis was clearly one of them. With him gone, I think that conservatives really feel like, you know, even if there is a Republican or two who doesn't want to see that expansion happen unlimited, that it really won't matter because they'll have enough of a majority anyway. So I think that they are really seeing this as they can now move forward, and there really isn't going to be a lot stopping them or even slowing it down.
Now, the state's going to be dealing with a budget shortfall, it looks like, and that's probably what state legislators are going to have to tackle first. What do we know so far about how they're planning to get a handle on that, on the budget deficit?
You know, I think, again, Speaker Voss, Governor Walker have both said that they feel like that is just a projection, that $1.8 billion budget shortfall, that they feel like that's assuming there's not going to be any growth. They seem to be confident that there is going to be growth, and so have been, I don't want to say dismissive, but have made it clear that they're not too concerned that that $1.8 billion is going to come to pass. I guess we'll just have to wait and see. But I think Democrats have pointed to that as a sign that things are going to need to change and that they have some concerns going forward.
Now, you mentioned briefly some of the initiatives that the GOP is going to be looking at in the state. One of these is from Governor Walker. He said during his campaign he'd like to start drug testing for people who are getting public benefits. Is that one that you see being on the top of the list?
I do. Speaker Voss mentioned it. Governor Walker's mentioned it several times. He, you know, in his victory speech the other night, he talked about wanting to move people from government dependence to true independence, and he feels like drug issues might be standing in the way of people getting jobs. I think critics would say that it's more of a punitive measure, but we'll really have to wait and see how he wants to implement it. It has been blocked elsewhere. A judge in Florida found it to be unconstitutional, and so we'll have to get some details about how he wants to implement that in a way that it wouldn't just be immediately blocked by the courts.
There's also been growing discontentment about the Common Core among Republicans. What kind of action do you expect to see in that area coming up?
You know, I think that what we're going to see is they've talked about replacing Common Core with educational standards that were developed in Wisconsin. There's a lot of critics of Common Core among Republicans and conservatives, and I think that we're going to pretty quickly see a move to try to replace Common Core with other educational standards.
Speaker Voss has also talked about reforming the Government Accountability Board, as you mentioned a little while ago, and changing also how John Doe investigations in the state are handled. Do you have a rough idea of what Speaker Voss has in mind about that?
You know, before the elections, it really sounded like he wanted to have Kevin Kennedy fired as quickly as possible, and basically it sounded like it was going to be a pretty dramatic overhaul of the Government Accountability Board. It seems like, I don't want to say that he backed away from those statements, but they did not seem as pointed yesterday in his press conference. So I'm not sure if they're still working out the details of how, you know, what they want to see changed at the Government Accountability Board. He said that he feels like it isn't as nonpartisan as it should be, that obviously Republicans and conservatives were pretty unhappy with the way the John Doe investigations have been conducted. And but I think we're trying to get some details right now of what Republican leaders want to see differently at those agencies.
Now, as a lot of analysts are saying, Governor Walker looks to be poising himself to be a presidential contender in 2016. What does that mean about the line he may have to walk between balancing what's best for the state and what will get the most attention for a presidential bid?
Yeah, I think that's certainly something that many, many people will be watching. I think that he's going to be under a pretty bright spotlight over these next coming months until people know whether he's running or not. I'm expecting a lot of will he or won't he stories coming out. I think that, you know, certainly his critics are concerned and have said that they are worried he's going to be thinking more about a presidential bid and what will look good for appealing to national conservatives than doing what's best for Wisconsin. Certainly his supporters would disagree and say, you know, he is solely motivated by trying to make Wisconsin better, and that he, you know, other people are only naming him because he's been so successful here, and that they want to see that success brought to Washington. So I think this is going to be one of those partisan splits, and I don't think they're going to agree on what his motivations are.
Okay, Mary, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Mary Spacuzza, state government reporter at the Wisconsin State Journal. She joined us to talk about the state legislature's upcoming agenda for the next term. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. If you're looking for an up-close experience with presidential history, look no further than DePere, Wisconsin. Today on Curious Wisconsin, we're looking at a collection of letters from the Founding Fathers and some china from the Lincoln-era White House on display at the White Pillars Museum in DePere.
The exhibition is called From the White House to White Pillars. The artifacts remain in the area thanks to a campaign by the Green Bay De Pere Antiquarian Society that raised $1.3 million in 2007 to buy them from the library and prevent them from being sold at auction.
Adam Stick is the director of the White Pillars Museum in De Pere. He joins us now to talk about the collection. Adam, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
So how did you come by this treasure trove of presidential artifacts?
Well, the De Pere Historical Society has always had a very cooperative relationship with the Green Bay De Pere Antiquarian Society, and while we were talking about this and that, and they mentioned that the letters were keyword, that they had the letters, that they would like to exhibit them, and we had some exhibit space, and it seemed like a wonderful opportunity to help us both. And in addition to that, the Lincoln China.
And how rare are these items?
You do find presidential letters. To the best of my knowledge, these are the only ones in the area, so we're very happy to have them here. You find them in private collections and in museums across the country. You do find examples of the Lincoln China. But again, this is the only museum in this area right now featuring an exhibit like this.
Can you tell us exactly what it is you have?
What we have are two wonderful plates of the Lincoln pattern. It was quite a bit of work to authenticate these, and what we found as we worked on this actually with the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library in Springfield, and what we discovered as we were researching this was that one of the plates we are very sure is not actually of the Lincoln administration. It's the exact same pattern, the exact same maker, but due to the maker's mark on the back, we can tell it was actually probably created during the Harrison administration a few years later.
Now, can you tell us a little bit about the original Lincoln China? What's the history there?
Every president, they order their own particular pattern of china. You can go to museums in Washington, D.C., where they have exhibits of all the different presidents. And the particular pattern, it's beautiful. It's purple with gold glint with an eagle in the center holding arrows. And this is what was ordered by Mary Todd Lincoln.
And is it intact, in good condition?
Both plates, we have a large dinner plate. That is the one that we feel very strongly is of the Harrison administration. And we have a small dessert plate with no maker's mark on the back, so that one we're not quite sure of. But they are both in pristine condition. The antiquarians also offered us a reproduction of the Lincoln China, which is also on exhibit, so you can tell the very distinct difference between the 19th century China and the modern day reproductions.
Now, presidents face a lot of decisions when they come into office, Lincoln maybe more so than most. What's the process of picking out the presidential china like?
Well, there's a whole story that goes along with this because Mary Todd was well known for spending a lot of money in furnishing the White House. In particular, during the time of the Civil War, she really tried to create a showcase mansion to show the awesomeness of the presidency. So this particular china, it's very well known, probably among the more beautiful patterns picked by any president.
Is this something that still goes on today? Presidents, whoever enters the White House, they're picking out china?
Oh, yes. Every president gets their own pattern.
And they don't register for it, though, at the local store, right?
Not exactly.
They get the whole kit up front.
Yes, these are custom designed for the president.
Now, you also have seven presidential letters on display, and where are those from?
We have letters dating from John Adams, from Thomas Jefferson, from James Madison, James Monroe, John Quincy Adams, one from Andrew Jackson, and then one from Grover Cleveland.
Were these all part of the same collection of presidential letters, or are they kind of a little bit here, a little bit there?
I believe the antiquarians purchased those all together.
And what is the content of these letters?
The letters are really fascinating, particularly of the early presidents, because they're all correspondence between these former presidents and a Philadelphia bookseller named Joseph de la Plaine.
And why was this this bookseller so interested in corresponding with these ex-presidents?
All of these letters pertain to the same topic. Mr. de la Plaine is asking the former presidents for either a memoir of themselves for his own collection or a portrait of themselves for his own collection. And all of the presidents very politely refuse him.
Well, why did they even take the time to respond to someone like that personally?
I was curious as to who Mr. de la Plaine was, and in cross-matching against the listings that that Monticello has, they have extensive listings of all of President Jefferson's correspondence. He had a steady correspondence with Mr. de la Plaine. So it seems to be very much like we order things online in lots. They were purchasing books from this gentleman in Philadelphia.
Oh, so he was actually selling books to Jefferson and other former presidents?
That is certainly what it seems like, yes.
Okay, so he wasn't just some random crank trying to get free stuff.
Oh, no, absolutely not. In all the letters, and essentially the same way, they had a relationship with him, and they all end, "with respect and my regards to you, sir." So clearly this is not them just answering fan mail, you could say. This is somebody they had a relationship with.
It must be fascinating to look at these letters and the different penmanship of all the presidents. You've got a sampling of some of the greatest men in American history. Is there anything that you can tell us just about how they look, what the penmanship is like?
Some of my favorites here, I love the John Adams letter because what he relays back to Mr. Delaplaine is that there are people selling my likeness who I've never met, much less sat for. he's particularly mentioned a Catholic priest who he met very briefly, and then the next thing he knew, this gentleman sold something like 20,000 likenesses of him, and he's very clear in the end of the letter, he didn't get a cut of it at all.
Now, how are these displayed at the museum? Can we actually lean in and read these in a case or something?
Oh, yes, you can lean in. Right, I'm looking at the case right now, and what I also did was I transcribed the letters because some of these are a bit difficult to read. In particular, the Jackson letter is very difficult to read. I understood that once I transcribed it, it's written within a year of his death to his friend Mary Gardner, and he particularly mentions his ailing health.
And what does he say about how he's doing?
He says that his health is ailing and that he is very happy to still have a friendship with this lady.
Do any of the ex-presidents here give any indication of their thoughts on the politics and where the nation has gone since their time in office?
There's really not a great deal of that. It's much more personal correspondence with Mr. Delaplaine, which makes for a really interesting look into the later lives of these presidents.
Now, you said you transcribed these letters, which must have been an honor. How do you do that without damaging them? Just procedurally, how does one go about doing that?
The letters are all encased in UV-protected frames, so they're protected from sunlight. And what I also did was I made digital images of them so that I could refine the handwriting as I needed to. My background in particular is in 18th and 17th century history, so I'm used to reading this kind of writing.
So we've been talking about this exhibition of presidential materials. What kind of other things do we see at the White Pillars Museum?
Oh, we have a great deal of things here on exhibit. We have a wonderful exhibit pertaining to Terry Musin, our own Miss America, Terry Musin, Miss America 1973. We do have her crown on permanent exhibit here. We have a magnificent digital archive, so you can come here and research all manners of Brown County history through our digital computer system, which is very unique. You don't find anything like this really in most of the state of Wisconsin.
Now, some people who get so up close and personal with history report feeling sort of a kinship either with the person whose items that they're looking at or kind of a high, just this connection with history. Did you feel that as you were, dealing with this china or reading and transcribing these letters?
I had to say once I first handled these Lincoln plates, and it was really fascinating to think, to picture Lincoln eating stew one night, drafting the Gettysburg Address while eating off one of these plates, which probably wasn't the case, but it's that very much that kind of, like you said, kinship that you feel in just handling these sort of things. And just getting a peek, beyond the presidency and the revolution, just into a little bit of the private lives of these men through these letters is just fascinating and really a privilege for me.
And what's the response been from visitors to the museum seeing the letters and the china?
Oh, we have people come in and they're absolutely fascinated by these. They love that they're here. The clear question we get a great deal is people have trouble reading them, which is why I do have transcriptions available for people to read and kind of match up the old handwriting with just kind of modern-day script.
Do you have any plans to try to sort of complete the set, get other pieces of presidential china, perhaps more letters?
Not at this time. Even going through these were not easy to authenticate. And they're in private collections all across the country. And right now we're very pleased with what we've got here.
And Adam, is there a part of American history that particularly stokes your interest?
My area of interest is actually in pre-revolutionary history, when many of these men were very young in their careers, kind of like I am now. So really that's where my background in my research has pertained, is pre-revolutionary history, which is really the history of De Pere in many ways. This is the oldest European community in Wisconsin, comes from Rapide de Pere. This is where the first Jesuit mission was set up in 1671.
All right. Well, thank you, Adam, so much for joining us and sharing these artifacts with us.
Thank you very much.
That's Adam Stick. He's director of the White Pillars Museum here in De Pere, Wisconsin, talking about the museum's exhibit of presidential history on display now. Our next guest set off on a philosophical journey through the world of religion, exploring the thinking behind our belief, our unbelief, and points in between, and how the concepts of God or godlessness work out in our thinking and our daily lives.
In a series of interviews, he talked to philosophers from a variety of traditions, believers in different religions, as well as agnostics and atheists. Throughout the year, he's posted those interviews on The Stone, a philosophy section on the New York Times website.
Gary Gutting joins us now. He's a professor of philosophy at the University of Notre Dame and a regular contributor to The Stone. Gary, thanks for joining us.
Good to be here.
So why did you set off on this project?
Well, I was especially interested in the fact, which I cited it actually in the first piece I wrote about, with the fact that a large proportion of philosophers, at least in the main United States departments, are atheists. That surprised me. Philosophers are a skeptical lot. I would have thought most of them would have been agnostics, as a matter of fact. So I was looking more for why up to 70% of philosophers in surveys say that they're atheists. And so I talked to about half of the people I talked to were atheists. And then others were various sorts of believers in Christianity or other religions, and try to get a sense of what was going on.
So what's the value in trying to apply reason to our system of belief or non-belief, whatever it might be?
Yeah, you have to do that if you're a human being for any beliefs that you've got. This is not peculiar to religion. It's also, you find it with regard to ethics or politics. I mean, obviously, people do have certain rock-bottom beliefs. Philosophers sometimes call them basic beliefs. That's just where they start from, okay? And maybe belief in God is like that. Maybe belief in a whole creed of a religion is like that. Whether or not it is, your basic beliefs give rise to further questions. First of all, there's questions about what logically follows from those beliefs. You believe several things. What are you committed to in virtue of that? Or you get challenges from other people whose views you might respect, or at least that you have to come to terms with. Or you find out about scientific results that seem to be in contradiction to what your beliefs are. You have to think them through. So everybody needs what I like to call intellectual maintenance for your beliefs. So regardless of whether there's total rationality and everything's all derived from reason, which may well not be true, is not usually true for us, anybody's system of beliefs, if they're taken seriously, need various forms of intellectual maintenance.
You say we have to do this, that we need this, but you also write that in your concluding piece that religious faith without a strong role for critical reason readily falls into fanaticism. How does a lack of that reasoned examination belief lead to fanaticism, maybe destructive behavior?
Yeah, well, that's when you're refusing to take account of any alternatives, and you also start deriving conclusions which might be ethically very bad about, you know, like unbelievers are bad and they must be eliminated or something of that sort. And then you just get into a set where you aren't able to you aren't willing to consider any alternatives to the system of belief that you've got. And then that can be very, very bad because there's no control. And again, I say that's true not only about religious beliefs, it's true with political beliefs, it's true with ethical beliefs. There's lots of beliefs that people have, which if they aren't subjected to some sort of reflective, rational control, they can get out of hand.
One theme that comes up in your series of interviews, there have been efforts over the years from atheist philosophers to prove that believing that theist belief is irrational,
yeah,
and vice versa, believers, mm-hmm, trying to prove that atheism is irrational. Is this a productive line of questioning and argument?
Well, it's not productive in the sense that you might hope that we get a decisive answer in which everyone finally agrees. That's certainly that certainly does not happen. That doesn't happen in politics. It doesn't happen in ethics either. It doesn't happen in most of the most interesting questions that we're concerned with as human beings. But it has resulted, I think, in considerable clarification of the beliefs, in considerable resources for thinking about what we believe and why we believe it. In other words, for helping us with our process of intellectually maintaining our beliefs, for working on them, developing them, and so on. Yeah, it's done a lot of good things that way.
Well, it's interesting to think when we encounter a different belief system, it seems like one path might be, as we learn more about it, we might drift away from our own original way of thinking, or the encounter with something different might actually reinforce what we believe to start with. Can you talk about those two alternatives a little?
Well, those two things can happen. I can be very concrete about it. I've always been to, in some meaningful sense, since I was born, associated with the belief in Catholic form of Christianity. I've been further away from it sometimes, closer other times. What in recent years has brought me closest to it is spending a lot of time thinking about and writing about the criticisms of religion by the new atheist movement. I think once you start to see how weak those criticisms are, you start to get more sympathetic, or at least I did, with religious points of view. So that's one way that it can go. Can go just the opposite of what you might expect, actually. But on the other hand, many people have had a belief in say a particular religion, and then got and had fallen away from it and had doubts about it, and then got that reinforced when they read, a lot of people read somebody like C.S. Lewis. Now, he never terribly impressed me, but a lot of people read that and say, wow, that's really clarified Christianity for me, and made it a lot more plausible. Other people have maybe been even religious in some sort of way, and then they read Richard Dawkins, the God delusion, as he calls it, and they're blown away and think, my God, this is so right. Well, I guess they don't think, my God, this is so right, but they say he's just so right, and atheism is obviously correct. He's got a very strong following of people who find him extremely convincing. One thing I've tried to do is suggest that he's not nearly as convincing as they might think he is.
Now, a lot of people might think, you know, or maybe not even consciously think, but do religion in a way that, you know, the religion is their daily or weekly practice. They go to church, they have a certain set of behaviors, prayers, devotions, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And this egg-headed philosophy stuff doesn't really enter into it. Is there a case that the practice is as important as the fundamental beliefs?
Yeah, well, in fact, in the final interview, so-called, that wrapped it all up, I allegedly interviewed myself, right? It's a little disconcerting thing to do. You have to keep yourself honest. But one point I brought up there, which I'd often thought about before, and that many of our many of my interviewees, both and incidentally atheists like Philip Kitcher at Columbia, and also many actually strong religious believers like Howard Wettstein, who's Jewish, but also says that he's a materialist and he's a naturalist. That is to say, I shouldn't say materialist, but naturalist, and doesn't think there are any supernatural beings. They all emphasize, and I would emphasize it too, that for almost everybody, religious belief starts on the level of practice. I mean, you don't just start out saying, wow, here's a great argument for the existence of God, so I'm going to believe in God. You start out usually by engaging in the practice of one or another religion, either born in it or you get interested in it from friends or you just are curious and you go. And I think, let's put it this way, for most believers, even the strongest believers, I think the very root of their belief is this. Practicing this religion, that is, living according to its precepts, engaging in its rituals, its prayers, its way of thinking, reading things that are written by people that are from its tradition, it's a good thing to do. I get something out of that. Certainly, I would say I would remain, I think it would always remain a Catholic, and always have, simply in those terms. I think I get a lot out of a close association. For me, it's especially the Catholic intellectual tradition, the writers like Augustine and Aquinas and Newman and those sorts of people. That means a lot to me, and I think it's important for me to read about those people and to think about them and to reflect on those doctrines and try to apply that in my life and so on. So I think practice is the starting point. And then I think the next thing is that obviously the doctrines have a lot of they make a lot of claims, right? They make what seem to be factual claims. They tell stories that they say are true. They give you doctrines about the Trinity, the Eucharist, and so forth. I think those can be very successfully used. And I'm not an exclusivist about this. I think the doctrines of many different religions can be used to better understand aspects of the human situation. I mean, take the evil that's in the world. We try to come to terms with it. Well, you can read what is basically a very brilliant story, the Book of Job, and you can learn a lot, you can understand a lot about evil from it, whether or not there actually was this God who spoke to Job, who had these terrible things happen to him, the devil was involved, and so on. That's all another matter. But just as you can read a great novel and come to understand things, you can learn a lot in the way of understanding from these doctrines. So you can get all of that before you get to the level of, are these doctrines actual factual truths about the way the world runs? And I myself am pretty agnostic about most claims made on in any religion about that this is actually the fact of the way the world was created, or this is the being that's behind it, and that being is exactly like this. I'm a religious agnostic. That is, I practice religion. I like to think in terms of religion. I think that part of my religion is saying I don't really know much about any of that, those actual factual details.
We're talking to philosopher Gary Gutting. He recently explored belief systems, including major world religions and agnosticism and atheism, in a series of interviews published on the New York Times website.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you worked with interfaith groups or explored belief systems different from yours? Do you think there's room for common ground among different faith groups or between believers, agnostics, and atheists? And do you believe in God in some way? And what does that exactly mean to you? Call 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org.
We'll continue the conversation after a look at the latest news with Kristen Durst.
We continue our conversation about religion, belief, and philosophy with Gary Gutting. He's a philosophy professor at Notre Dame, and he did a series of interviews on the New York Times website looking at different faiths and belief systems around the world.
And you can join the conversation. How have your own beliefs evolved through your life? Have you checked out a belief or non-belief systems different than your own? Did that challenge your worldview or reinforce it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. We'll go to our callers now. We've got Mike on the line in Green Bay. Mike, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to sort of make a statement. You know, I'm first generation Vietnamese American, and I was born in Arkansas, and my sister was brought over at 1 year old. And me and my sister were First Southern Baptist, but my parents are 100% Buddhist. But we were adopted by a church, you know, adopt a family because of the war. So from the research I found and what I've been exposed to, it's really where you're born. Like a big part of it is where you're born and raised, obviously.
Interesting. So Gary, a lot of our religious belief is the happenstance of our birth, or in this case, our adoption into a religious faith.
Yeah, that's really interesting, the situation Mike is in, because he has, in a way, a heritage of the Buddhist faith, but he's lived out one in terms of the Baptist faith. It is true. I mean, one of the first ways to get yourself thinking about your religion is to ask yourself, supposing I had been born in Vietnam, supposing I'd been born in Saudi Arabia, supposing I'd been born in communist China back in Mao's time, what would be my religious beliefs? Well, they very likely would not be similar to what you have. That's certainly true. So there's a danger, I think, in any highly exclusivist way of thinking about religion. I think any intellectually plausible way of any intellectually responsible way of thinking about religion has got to say, look, this is one way of thinking about these truths or these realities that are beyond the world, but there've got to be other ways too, and I'm not going to be able to say that this is the only way or the best way. I think you have to be open to that. I don't see where exclusivism gets you anywhere. One of the atheists I interviewed, Philip Kitcher, formulated it, and he's not the only one who has formulated this, but it's a very good challenge. It says, look, and a lot of the new atheists like to make this point. They say, if you hold a strong particular sectarian religious belief, you actually deny the beliefs of all other religions that contradict your belief, which they usually do. Now, think about it. Do you have any better reason for accepting your religion's belief than the people who are in the other religious that have been raised in those other religions have to believe theirs? If you were in their situation, wouldn't you have their beliefs and wouldn't you be equally entitled to it? I think that's a very strong point. And it got to lead us, I think, to a non-exclusivist view of religion.
Thanks a lot for the call, Mike. And we'll go now to Tim in Wisconsin Dells. Tim, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for calling. Thank you for taking my call. Anyways, I didn't grow up religious at all by any means, and fell in love with a girl from a very, Catholic family. And for 6 years now, I've been doing communion because I thought I was supposed to, because they would drag me to church. And it finally came about where my brother-in-law asked me why I was taking communion, and the whole family's been talking about it for the last 6 years, since I'm not Catholic. I was just trying to be nice. But anyways, my wife isn't, she doesn't practice anymore either. She doesn't believe in it. But she turns into a completely different person when she's around her family and we have to go to church.
Uh-huh.
And it just makes me feel uncomfortable. So I was wondering if you had any advice.
Interesting. When in Roman Catholicism, do as the Roman Catholics do, doesn't actually apply in that particular situation. But trying to fit in with a religious tradition that isn't our own. Interesting situation, Gary.
Yeah, that is true. And sometimes I think you do have to be polite. New atheists are often not polite, and often will just be very critical. There are a lot of religious people, especially of a fundamentalist sort, that are like that. But you can't. I mean, I don't think you should be deceitful. And I guess I would say I wouldn't go to communion if I didn't believe or didn't think I should be practicing that particular religion. Wouldn't want to be acting as though I believe something I didn't believe. On the other hand, I wouldn't want to just flaunt my lack of faith in situations where other people would be made very uncomfortable by it.
All right. Well, good luck sorting that out, Tim. We'll go back to our callers with Ellen on the line in Milwaukee. Ellen, hi.
Hi. Oh, so good to talk to you. I grew up hearing the names Augustine and St. Thomas Aquinas, and, very unusual kind of upbringing. My father was a Irish Catholic from Chicago, professor of philosophy, Thomist, and he raised us very, very strictly, so none of us wanted to be Catholic. I especially didn't want to be Catholic because I was a girl, a woman. And I didn't like, I said, I'll be a Catholic when I can be a priest, Dad.
Yeah, you don't want to be a member of an organization you can't be in charge of, right? I mean,
yeah. But in the past, dozen years or so, I've been finally realizing that I am Catholic by culture. My values are Catholic. I hang out with Catholic or ex-Catholic people. And the other thing is that I am now dealing with the question of evil. And knowing that I'm going to have to get deeper into reading or something. My sister died this year, a couple months ago, and she died she was not sick. She died as a result of being given care in a very, very poor care place. Mm-hmm. And it was excruciating to watch her get sicker and weaker and then die. And so I believe I was in the presence of evil going through this experience with her. And it's really affecting me. I'm trying to find meaning in life. But anyway, just the two things. I accept my Catholicism by culture happily. I don't like the dogmas. I don't go to church. But I see myself as a cultural Catholic, and I'm finally grateful for that heritage.
Wow, Ellen, thank you so much. A lot there, Gary. And Ellen, I'm sorry for your loss and the experience with your sister. But Gary, take that where you want to go with it.
Yeah, well, I really appreciate what Ellen's saying here. I think often the notion of cultural Catholic is used in a very a deprecatory way. You're just a cultural Catholic or whatever. But I think Catholicism is almost above all a cultural phenomenon, more even than it is an institutional phenomenon. I myself don't have a great deal of sympathy with much of what goes on in the institutional church. and the hierarchy, I don't think is or should be definitive with regard to how I think or what views I take. But I do have a huge respect for that. It's not just intellectual; it's artistic, it's ethical. The whole culture that's been developed over 2,000 years in the Catholic Church, and I think that that's a very important way to be Catholic. And one thing I would encourage is that I think that people who have a sympathy for some of the rituals and want to go to church, even if they don't have a doctrinal belief or they don't have a sympathy with the hierarchy, I think they should, there's no reason they shouldn't regard themselves as part of the Catholic Church. There are many different ways of being Catholic, and some of the best are deeply rooted cultural ones.
Thanks a lot for that call, Ellen. And Gary, you and Ellen have a situation probably a lot of people have some permutation of sorting out what are my spiritual beliefs. Do they fit in with the hierarchy or the institution, whatever the faith may be? Is this one of the big questions of our time?
Well, it is a big question, I think. I think that there is a very important question that's interesting also, and I think a lot of people are interested in this. Do we have to have religion, or maybe more broadly spirituality, does it have to be associated with the institutional structures of churches? Churches, of course, have a vested interest in saying, absolutely, if you're not belonging to one church or another, and some of them, they're rather broad-minded now, so you can pick the church you want to belong to, but you should belong to a church. I don't know. Is the religious impulse, is our desire for a spiritual life, is that necessarily best fulfilled in the institutional structures of these social organizations that we call churches? One thing I learned when I talked to people that knew a whole lot about Eastern religions, especially Buddhism and Hinduism, was that those religions are frequently, they have a strong social basis in society, but they don't have anything, often they don't have anything nearly like what the Catholic Church or even some of the Protestant churches have in terms of a fixed institutional structure. So I'm not sure that this is a necessary part of religious life, and I think a lot of people get pushed away from religious life because they think it means belonging to a church.
Well, Gary, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been great to be here.
That's Gary Gutting. He's professor of philosophy at the University of Notre Dame. You can find his series of interviews on religion on the New York Times website. It's part of The Stone. That's their philosophy blog.